Somebody coming to death's door and not knowing it. Not having the slightest sweet mother idea. And Daddy takes the .30-06 out of the closet, the very one he used to end Paul's life. Or the life of the thing inside of him. Shoes clomp up the porch steps. There are three steps, and the middle one squeaks, as it has forever, world without end, amen. Daddy, no, I say in a low, pleading voice, as Andrew Sparky Landon goes toward the closed door in his new and oddly graceful scissors walk, the rifle held up to high port in front of him. I'm still holding the plate, but now my fingers feel numb and I think I'm going to drop it. Mother Smuck will fall to the floor and break, and that man out there, the last sounds he's ever going to hear in his life are a breaking plate and Dick Curless on the radio singing about the Haynesville woods in this stinking forgotten farmhouse. Daddy, no, I say again, pleading with all my heart and trying to put that plea into my eyes. Sparky Landon hesitates, then stands against the wall so that if the door opens, when the door opens, it will hide him. And a series of knuckle raps comes on that door even as he does so. I have no trouble reading the words that form silently on my father's whisker-framed lips. Then get rid of him, Scoot. I go to the door. I switch the plate I meant to dry from my right hand to my left one, and open the door. I see the man standing there with terrible clarity. The U.S. gypsum man isn't very tall. At 5'7" or 5'8", he isn't really that much taller than I am. But he looks like the very apotheosis of authority in his black-billed cap, his khaki pants, with their razor-sharp creases, and his khaki shirt showing beneath his heavy black car coat, which is half unzipped. He's wearing a black tie and carrying some sort of little case. Not quite a briefcase. It will be another few years before I learn the word portfolio. He's kind of fat and clean-shaven, with pink and shining cheeks. There are galoshes on his feet, kind that have zippers rather than buckles. I look at the whole picture, and I think that if ever there was a man who looked meant to be shot on a porch in the country, it's this man. Even the single hair curling from one of his nostrils proclaims that, yes, this is the guy, all right, the very one sent to take a bullet from the scissor man's gun. Even his name, I think, is the kind you read in the paper under a headline screaming, "Murdered." "Hello, son," he says. "You must be one of Sparky's boys. I'm Frank Halsey from the plant, head of personnel." And he holds out his hand. I think I won't be able to take it, but I do. And I think I won't be able to talk, but I can do that, too. And my voice sounds normal. I'm all that stands between this man and a bullet in the heart of the head, so it better. "Yes, sir, I am. I'm Scott." "Good to know you, Scott," he says, looking past me into the living room, and I try to see what he's seeing. I tried to pick it up the day before, but God knows what kind of job I did. I'm just a smucking kid, after all. "We've kind of been missing your father." "Well, I think you're awful close to missing everything, Mr. Halsey. Your job, your wife, your kids, if you got them."
"He didn't call you from Philly?" I ask.
I have absolutely no idea where this is coming from or where it's going, but I'm not afraid. Not at this part. I can make shit up all day long. What I'm afraid of is that Daddy will lose control and just start blazing away through the door. Hit Halsey, maybe. Hit both of us, probably. "No, son, he sure didn't." The sleet keeps ticking down on the porch roof, but at least he's under cover, so I don't absolutely have to invite him in. But what if he invites himself in? How can I stop him? I'm just a kid, standing here in my slippers with a plate in my hand and a dish towel slung over my shoulder. "Well, he's been awful worried about his sister," I say, and I think of the baseball biography I've been reading. It's on my bed upstairs. I also think of Daddy's car, which is parked around back under the shed overhang. If Mr. Halsey walked to the far end of the porch, he'd see it. "She's got the disease that killed that famous ball player from the Yankees."
"Sparky's sister's got Lou Gehrig's? Oh, shit. I mean, shoot. I didn't even know he had a sister."
"Neither did I think." "Son, Scott, that's a shame. Who's watching out for you boys while he's gone?"
"Mrs. Cole from down the road."
Jackson Cole is the name of the guy who wrote Iron Man of the Yankees.
She comes in every day. And besides, Paul knows 4 different ways to make meatloaf.
Mr. Halsey chuckles. 4 ways, huh? When's Sparky gonna be back?
Well, she can't walk anymore, and she breathes like this. I take a big, whooping gasp of air. It's easy because all at once my heart is beating like crazy. It was going slow when I was pretty sure Daddy was going to kill Mr. Halsey. But now that I see a chance we might get out of it, it's going 6 licks to the minute.
Aw, sugar, says Mr. Halsey. Now he thinks he understands everything.
Well, that's just about the worst thing I ever heard of.
He reaches under his coat and drags out his wallet. He opens it and takes out a $1 bill. Then he remembers that I supposedly have a brother and takes out another one. And all at once, Lisi, the strangest thing happened. All at once, I wished my father would kill him. Here, son, he says, and also all at once I know, like reading his mind, that he's forgotten my name, and I hate him even more. Take it. 1 for you and 1 for your brother. Treat yourselves at that little store down the road.
I don't want his smucking dollar, and Paul has no more use for his, but I take them and say thank you, sir. And he says, you're welcome, son, and he ruffles my hair. And while he's doing that, I glance over to my left and see one of my father's eyes peering through the crack in the door. I see the muzzle of the rifle, too. Then Mr. Halsey finally goes back down the steps. I close the door, and my father and I watch as he gets into his company car and starts backing down the long driveway. It comes to me that if he gets stuck, he'll walk up again and ask to use the phone and end up dying anyway. But he doesn't get stuck, and will kiss his wife hello that night after all, and tell her he gave 2 poor boys a couple of dollars to treat themselves with. I look down and see I'm still holding the 2 bills, and I give them to my father. He tucks them away into his pants pocket without so much as a look.
He'll be back, Daddy says. Him or some other. You did a good job, Scott, but tape will only hold a wet package for so long.
I take a hard stare at him and see that he is my daddy. At some point, while I was talking to Mr. Halsey, my daddy came back. It's the last time I'll ever really see him. He sees me looking at him and kind of nods. Then he looks at the 30-06.
I'm gonna get rid of this, he says. I'm going down, that can't be—
No, Daddy.
Can't be helped. But I'll be sweet fucked if I'll take a bunch of people like that Halsey with me. So they can put me on the 6 o'clock news for the Gomers to drool over. They'd put you and Paul there, too. Of course they would. Alive or dead, you'd be the lunatics, boys.
Daddy, you'll be okay, I tell him, and try to hug him. You're okay right now? He pushes me away, kind of laughing.
Yeah, sometimes people with malaria can quote Shakespeare, he says. You stay here, Scotty. I got a chore to do. It won't take long.
He walks off down the hall, past the bench I finally jumped off of all those years ago, and into the kitchen. Head down, the deer gun in one hand. Once he's out the kitchen door, I follow him, and I'm looking out the window over the sink when he crosses the backyard, coatless in the sleet, head still down, still holding the 30-06. He puts it on the icy ground only long enough to push the cover off the dry well. He needs both hands to do that because the sleet has bound the cover to the brick. Then he picks the gun up again, looks at it for a second, almost like he's saying goodbye, and slides it into the gap he's made. After that, he comes back to the house with his head still down and ice drops darkening the shoulders of his shirt. It's only then that I notice his feet are bare. I don't think he ever realizes at all. He doesn't seem surprised to see me in the kitchen. He takes out the $2 bills Mr. Halsey gave me, looks at them, then looks at me.
You sure you don't want these?
He asks. I shake my head. Not if they were the last $2 bills on Earth. I can see he likes that answer.
Good, he says. But now let me tell you something, Scott. You know your Nana's trying to break front in the dining room?
Sure.
If you look in the blue pitcher on the top shelf, you're gonna find a roll of money. My money, not Halsey's. Do you understand the difference?
Yes, I say.
Yeah, I bet you do. You're a lot of things, but dumb had never been one of them. If I were you, Scotty, I'd take that roll of bills, it's around $700, and put my act on the road. Stick 5 in my pocket and the rest in my boot. 10's too young to be on the road, even for a little while, and I think the chances are probably 9 to 5 in 100 somebody'll rob you of your roll even before you make it over the bridge into Pittsburgh. But if you stay here, something bad's gonna happen. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, but I can't go, I say.
There's lots of things people think they can't do, and then discover they can when they find themselves tight-wired, Daddy says.
He looks down at his feet, which are all pink and raw-looking.
If you were to make it to the Berg, I believe a boy bright enough to get rid of Mr. Halsey with a story about Lou Gehrig's disease and a sister I don't have might be bright enough to look under the C's in the telephone book and find child welfare. Or you might could knock around a little bit and maybe find an even better situation if he wasn't to get separated from that roll of cash. 700 parceled out 5 or 10 bucks at a time will last a kid a while, if he's smart enough not to get picked up by the cops, and lucky enough not to get robbed of any more of it than what happens to be in his pocket.
I tell him again, I can't go.
Why not?
But I can't explain. Some of it is having lived almost my whole life in that farmhouse, with almost no one for company but Daddy and Paul. What I know of other places I have gotten mostly from 3 sources, the television, the radio, and my imagination. Yes, I've been to the movies, and I've been to the Berg 6 times, but always with my father and big brother. The thought of going out there in that roaring strangeness alone scares the living Jesus out of me. And, more to the point, I love him. Not in the simple and uncomplicated, until the last few weeks at least, way I loved Paul. But yes, I love him. He has cut me and hit me, called me smuckhead and nummy, and glue-foot mother smucker. He has terrorized many of my childhood days, and sent me to bed on many nights feeling small and stupid and worthless. But those bad times have yielded their own perverse treasures. They have turned each kiss to gold, each of his compliments, even the most offhand, into things to be treasured. And even at 10, because I'm his son, his blood, maybe, I understand that his kisses and compliments are always sincere. They are always true things. He is a monster, but the monster is not incapable of love. That was the horror of my father, little Lisi. He loved his boys. I just can't, I say. He thinks about this, about whether or not to press me, I suppose, and then just nods again.
All right, but listen to me, Scott. What I did to your brother, I did to save your life. Do you know that?
Yes, Daddy.
But if I were to do something to you, it'd be different. It would be so bad I might go to hell for it, even if there was something else inside making me do it.
His eyes shift away from mine then, and I know he's seeing them again, them, and that pretty soon it won't be him I'm talking to anymore. Then he looks back at me, and I see him clearly for the last time.
You won't let me go to hell, will you?
He asks me.
You wouldn't let your daddy go to hell and burn there forever, mean as I've been to you some of the time.
No, Daddy, I say, and I can hardly talk.
You promise? On your brother's name?
On Paul's name. He looks away, back into the corner.
I'm going to lie down, he says. Fix yourself something to eat if you want, but don't leave this smucking kitchen all beshitted.
That night I wake up, or something wakes me up, and I hear the sleet coming down on the house harder than ever. I hear a crash out back, and I know it's a tree falling over from the weight of ice on it. Maybe it was another tree falling over that woke me up, but I don't think so. I think I heard him on the stairs, even though he's trying to be quiet. There's no time to do anything but slide out of bed and hide underneath it, so that's what I do, even though I know it's hopeless. Under the bed is where kids always hide, and it'll be the first place he looks. I see his feet come in the door. They're still bare. He never says a word. Just walks over to the bed and stands beside it. I think he'll stand beside it like he did before, then maybe sit down on it, but he never. Instead, I hear him make a kind of grunting sound, like he does when he's lifting something heavy, a box or something. And he goes up on the balls of his feet, and there's a whistling in the air, and then a terrific sprung noise, and the mattress and the box spring both bow down in the middle, and dust puffs along the floor, and the point of the pickaxe from out in the shed comes shooting through the bottom of my bed. It stops in front of my face, not an inch from my mouth. It seems like I can see every flake of rust on it, and the shiny place where it scraped on one of the bed springs. It stays still for a second or two, then there's more grunting, and a terrific pig squealing as he tries to pull it out. He tries hard, but it's good and stuck. The point wiggles and waggles back and forth in front of my face, and then he leaves off. I see his fingers appear below the edge of the bed then, and know that he's rested his palms on the balls of his knees. He's bending down, means to look under the bed and make sure I'm there before working that pickaxe free. I don't think. I just close my eyes and go. It's the first time since I buried Paul, and it's the first time from the second floor. I have just a second to think I'll fall, but I don't care. Anything's better than hiding under the bed and seeing the stranger wearing my daddy's face look under and see me looking back, cornered. Anything's better than seeing the bad gunky stranger who owns him now. And I do fall, but only a little, only a couple of feet, and only, I think, because I believed I would. So much about Booyah Moon is about simple belief. There, seeing really is believing, at least some of the time. As long as you don't wander too far into the woods and get lost. It was night there, Lisey, and I remember it well, because it was the only time I went there at night on purpose. 15. Oh, Scott, Lisey said, wiping at her cheeks. Each time he broke from the present tense and spoke to her directly was like a blow, but sweet. Oh, I'm so sorry. She checked to see how many pages were left, not many. 8? No, 10. She bent to them again, turning each into the growing pile in her lap as she read it. 16. I leave a cold room where a thing wearing my father's skin is trying to kill me, and sit up beside my brother's grave on a summer night, softer than velvet. The moon rides the sky like a tarnished silver dollar, and the laughers are having a party deep in the fairy forest. Every now and then, something else, something deeper in, I think, lets out a roar. Then the laughers are quiet for a while, but I guess whatever amuses them is eventually more than they can bear in silence, because up they start all over again. First one, then two, then half a dozen, then the whole damn Institute of Risibility. Something too big to be a hawk or an owl sails voicelessly across the moon. Some kind of night-hunting bird special to this place, I guess. Special to Booyah Moon. I can smell all the perfumes that Paul and I loved so much, but now they smell sour and curdled, somehow bed-pissy. Like if you breathed too deep of them, they'd sprout claws way up in your nose and dig in there. Down Purple Hill, I see drifting jellyfish globes of light. I don't know what they are, but I don't like them. I think that if they touch me, they might latch on, or maybe burst and leave an itchy sore place that would spread like poison ivy if you touched it. It's creepy by Paul's grave. I don't want to be afraid of him, and I'm not really, but I keep thinking of the thing inside him. And wondering if maybe it's in him still. And if things over here that are nice in daylight turn to poison at night, maybe a sleeping bad thing, even one hibernating way down in dead and rotting flesh, could come back to life. What if it shot Paul's arms out of the ground? What if it made his dirty dead hands grab me? What if his grinning face came rising up to my own, with dirt running from the corners of his eyes like tears? I don't want to cry. 10 is too old to cry, especially if you've been through the things I have. But I'm starting to blubber. I can't help it. Then I see one sweetheart tree standing a little bit apart from all the others, with its branches spread out in what looks like a low cloud. And to me, Lisey, that tree looked kind. I didn't know why then, but I think that now, all these years later, I do. Writing this has brought it back. The night lights, those scary cold balloons drifting just above the ground, wouldn't go under it. And as I got closer to it, I realized that this one tree, at least, smelled as sweet, or almost as sweet, at night as it did in the daytime. That's the tree you're sitting under now, little Lisi, if you're reading this last story. And I'm very tired. I don't think I can do the rest of it the justice it deserves, although I know I must try. It's my last chance to talk to you, after all. Let us say that there's a little boy who sits in the shelter of that tree for, well, who knows, really. Not all that long night, but until the moon, which always seems to be full here, have you noticed, is down, and he has dozed in and out of half a dozen strange and sometimes lovely dreams, at least one of which will later become the basis of a novel, long enough for him to name that wonderful shelter the Story Tree. And long enough for him to know that something awful, something far worse than the paltry evil which has seized his father, has turned its casual gaze toward him, and marked him for later notice, perhaps, and then turned its obscene and unknowable mind once more away. That was the first time I sensed the fellow who has lurked behind so much of my life, Lisi, the thing that has been the darkness to your light, and who also feels, as I know you always have, that everything is the same. That is a wonderful concept, but it has its dark side. I wonder if you know. I wonder if you ever will. 17. I know, Lisi said. I do now. God help me, I do. She looked at the pages again. 6 left. Only 6, and that was good. Afternoons in Vuyamun were long, but she thought that this one had finally begun to fade. It was really time to be getting back. Back to her house. Her sisters. Her life. She had begun to understand how it was to be done. 18. There comes a time when I hear the laughers beginning to draw closer to the edge of the fairy forest, and I think their amusement has taken on a sardonic, perhaps stealthy undertone. I peer around the trunk of my sheltering tree, and I think I see dark shapes slipping from the darker mass of the trees at the edge of the woods. This may be my overactive imagination, but I don't think so. I think my imagination, febrile as it is, has been exhausted by the many shocks of the long day and longer night, and that I have been reduced to seeing exactly what is there. As if to confirm this, there comes a slobbering chuckle from the high grass, not 20 yards from where I am crouching. Once more, I don't think about what I'm doing. I simply close my eyes and feel the chill of my bedroom fold itself around me once more. A moment later, I'm sneezing from the disturbed dust under my bed. I rear up, face contorted in a nearly gruesome effort to sneeze as quietly as possible, and I thump my forehead on the broken box spring. If the pick had still been sticking through, I might have gashed myself badly or even put out one of my eyes, but it's gone. I drag myself out from under my bed on my elbows and my knees, conscious that a sickly 5 o'clock light is soaking in through the window. It's sleeting harder than ever by the sound, but I hardly notice. I swivel my head from my floor-level position, peering stupidly around at the shambles that used to be my bedroom. The closet door has been pulled off the top hinge and leans drunkenly into the room from the lower one. My clothes have been scattered, and many of them, most of them, it looks like, have been torn apart, as if the thing inside of Daddy has taken out on them what it couldn't take out on the boy who should have been inside them. Far worse, it has torn my few treasured paperback books, sports biographies and science fiction novels mostly, to shreds. Their flimsy covers lie in pieces everywhere. My bureau has been overturned, the drawers slung to the corners of the room. The hole where the pickaxe went through my bed looks as big as a moon crater, and I think that's where my belly would have been if I'd been lying there. And there's a faint, sour smell. It reminds me of how Vuyamun smelled at night, but it's more familiar. I try to put a name on it and can't. All I can think of is bad fruit, and although that's not quite right, turns out to be very close. I don't want to leave the room, but I know I can't stay there because eventually he'll be back. I find a pair of jeans that aren't ripped and put them on. My sneakers are gone, I don't know where. But maybe my boots will still be in the mudroom, and my coat. I'll put them on and run out into the sleet. Down the driveway, following Mr. Halsey's half-frozen slushy car tracks, to the road. Then down the road to Muley's store. I'll run for my life into some future I can't even imagine. Unless, that is, he catches me first and kills me. I have to climb over the bureau which is blocking the door to get into the hall. Once I'm out there, I see the thing has knocked down all the pictures and knocked holes in the walls, and I know I'm looking at more of its anger at not being able to get at me. Out here, the sour fruit smell is strong enough to recognize. There was a Christmas party at U.S. Jipham last year. Daddy went because he said it would look funny if he didn't. The man who drew his name gave him a jug of homemade blackberry wine for a present. Now, Andrew Landon has got a lot of problems, and he'd probably be the first to admit it if caught in an honest moment, but alcohol isn't one of them. He poured himself a jelly glass of that wine before dinner one night, between Christmas and New Year's this was, with Paul chained in the cellar. Took one sip, grimaced, started to pour it down the sink, then saw me looking and held it out.
"You want to try this, Scott?" he asked. "See what all the shouting's about? Hey, if you like it, you can have the whole sweet mother gallon."
I'm as curious about booze as any kid, I guess, but that smell was too fruity, rancid. Maybe the stuff makes you happy like I've seen on TV, but I could never lick that gone-dead fruit smell. I shook my head.
"You're a wise child, Scooter, old Scoot," he said, and poured the stuff in the jelly glass down the sink.
But he must have saved the rest of the jug, or just forgot about it, because that's what I smell now, sure as God made little fishes, and strong. By the time I get to the foot of the stairs, it's a stench, and now I hear something besides the steady rattle of the sleet on the boards and the tinny tick-tock of it on the windows. George Jones. It's Daddy's radio, tuned into WWVA like always, playing very soft. And I also hear snoring. The relief is so great that tears go spilling down my cheeks. The thing I've been most afraid of is that he's laid up, waiting for me to show myself. Now, listening to those long, ragged snores, I know that he's not. Nevertheless, I'm careful. I detour through the dining room so I can come into the living room from behind the sofa. The dining room is also a shambles. Nana's brake front has been overturned, and it looks to me like he made a pretty good effort to turn it into kindling. All the dishes are broken. So's the blue pitcher, and the money inside it has been torn to pieces. Green shreds have been flung every which ever. Some even hang from the central light fixture like New Year's Eve confetti. Apparently, the thing inside Daddy has no more use for money than it does for books. In spite of those snores, in spite of being on the couch's blind side, I peer into the living room like a soldier peering over the lip of a foxhole after an artillery barrage. It's a needless precaution. His head's hanging off one end of the couch, and his hair, which he hasn't taken the scissors to since before Paul went bad, is so long it's almost touching the rug. I could have marched through there crashing a pair of cymbals and he wouldn't have stirred. Daddy isn't just asleep in the jumbled wreckage of that room. He is unsmucking conscious. A little further in and I see there's a cut running up one cheek, and his closed eyes have a purplish, exhausted look. His lips have slid back from his teeth, making him look like an old dog that fell asleep trying to snarl. He covers the couch with an old Navajo blanket to keep off grease and spilled food, and he's wrapped part of it over him. He must have been tired of busting things up by the time he got in here, because he's poked out the eye of the television and smashed the glass over his dead wife's studio portrait and called it good. The radio's in its usual place on the end table, and that gallon jug is on the floor beside it. I look at the jug and can hardly believe what I'm seeing. There's not but an inch or so left. It's almost impossible for me to believe he's drunk so much, he who isn't used to drinking at all. But the stink hanging around him, so thick I can almost see it, is very persuasive. The pickaxe leans against the head of the sofa, and there's a piece of paper stuck on the end that came down through my bed. I know it's a note he's left for me, and I don't want to read it, but I have to. He's written on three lines, but they're only 8 words, too few to ever forget. Kill me. Then put me with Paul. Please. 19. Lisi, crying harder than ever, turned this page into her lap along with the others. Now there were only 2 left. The printing had grown loose, a little wandering, not always sticking to the lines, quite clearly tired. She knew what came next.
I put a pickaxe in his head while he was asleepin',
he had told her under the yum-yum tree. And did she have to read the details here? Was there anything in the marriage vows about having to subject yourself to your dead husband's confession of patricide? And yet those pages called to her, cried to her like some lonely thing that has lost everything but its voice. She dropped her eyes to the final pages, determined that if she must finish, she would do so as quickly as she could. 20.
I don't want to, but I take up the pickaxe anyway, and stand there with it in my hands, looking at him, the lord of my life, the tyrant of all my days. I have hated him often, and he has never given me cause to love him enough. I know that now. But he has given me some, especially during those nightmare weeks after Paul went bad. And in that 5 o'clock living room, with the day's first gray light creeping in and the sleep ticking like a clock, and the sound of his wheezing snores below me, and an ad on the radio for some discount furniture store in Wheeling, West Virginia I will never visit, I know it comes down to a bald choice between those 2, love and hate. Now I'll find out which one rules my child's heart. I can let him live, and run down the road to Muley's, run into some unknown new life, and that will condemn him to the hell he fears and in many ways deserves, richly deserves. First hell on earth, the hell of a cell in some loony bin, and then maybe hell forever after, which is what he really fears. Or I can kill him and set him free. This choice is mine to make, and there is no God to help me make it, for I believe in none. Instead, I pray to my brother, who loved me until the bad gunky stole his heart and mind. I ask him to tell me what to do if he's there, and I get an answer. Although whether it is really from Paul or just my own imagination masquerading as Paul, I suppose I'll never know. In the end, I don't see that it matters. I need an answer, and I get one. In my ear, just as clearly as he ever spoke when he was alive, Paul says, "Daddy's prize is a kiss." I take hold of the pickaxe, then. The ad on the radio finishes, and Hank Williams comes on, singing, "Why don't you love me like you used to do? How come you treat me like a worn-out shoe?" And 21. Here, 3 lines were blank before the words took up again, this time in the past tense and addressing her directly. The rest was crammed together with almost no regard for the blue-ruled notebook lines, and Lisi was sure he had written the final passage in a single rush. She read it the same way, turning over to the last page as she did, and continuing on, continually wiping her tears so she could see clearly enough to get the sense of what he was saying. The mental seeing part, she found, was hellishly easy. The little boy, barefooted, wearing perhaps his only pair of untorn jeans, raising the pickaxe over his sleeping father in the gray pre-dawn light while the radio plays, and for a moment it only hangs there in the air that reeks of blackberry wine, and everything is the same. Then 22. I brought it down. Lisi, I brought it down in love, I swear, and I killed my father. I thought I might have to hit him with it again, but that single blow was enough, and all my life it's been on my mind. All my life it's been the thought inside every thought. I get up thinking I killed my father, and I go to bed thinking it. It has moved like a ghost behind every line I ever wrote in every novel. Any story, I killed my father. I told you that day under the yum-yum tree, and I think that you gave me just enough relief to keep me from exploding completely 5 years or 10 or 15 down the line. But a statement isn't the same as telling. Lisi, if you're reading this, I've gone on.
I think my time is short, but such time as I had, and it was very good time, is all down to you. You have given me so much. Just give me this much more. Your eye on these last few words. The hardest I've ever written. No tale can tell how ugly such dying is, even if it's instantaneous. Thank God I didn't hit him a glancing blow and have to do it again. Thank God there was no squealing or crawling. I hit him dead center, right where I meant to. But even mercy is ugly in the living memory. That's a lesson I learned well when I was just 10. His skull exploded. Hair and blood and brain showered up, all over that blanket he'd spread on the back of the couch. Snot flew out of his nose, and his tongue fell out of his mouth. His head went over to the side, and I heard soft, puttering noises as the blood and brains leaked out of his head. Some of it splashed on my feet, and it was warm. Hank Williams was still on the radio. One of Daddy's hands made a fist, then opened again. I smelled shit, and I knew he'd left a load in his pants. And I knew that was the last of him. The pickaxe was still stick out of his head. I crept away into the corner of the room and curled up and cried. And cried and cried. I guess maybe I slept some, too, I don't know. But there came a time when it was brighter and the sun was almost out, and I think it might have been noonish. If so, I guess 7 hours or so went by. That was when I first tried to take my daddy to Booyah Moon and couldn't. I thought if I got something to eat, so I did, but I still couldn't. Then I thought if I took a bath and got the blood off me, his blood, and clean up some of the mess around where he was, but still I couldn't. I tried and I tried. Off and on quite a bit. 2 days, I guess. Sometimes I'd look at his wrap in the blanket and make believe he would say, "You keep on plugging, Scoot, you old sumbitch. You make it," like in a story. I'd try, then I'd clean, try and clean, eat something, try some more. I cleaned that whole house, top to bottom. Once I went to Booyah by myself, prove I still had the knack, and I did, but I couldn't take my daddy. I tried so hard, Lacey. 23. Several blank lines here. At the bottom of the last page he had written, "Some things are like an anchor. Lacey, do you remember?" "I do, Scott," she murmured. "I do. And your father was one of them, wasn't he?" Wondering how many days and nights in all, how many days and nights alone with the corpse of Andrew Sparky Landon before Scott finally gave up plugging and invited the world in. Wondering how in God's name he had stood up to it without going completely insane. There was a little more on the other side of the sheet. She flipped it over and saw that he had answered one of her questions.
5 days I tried. Finally gave up and warped him in that blanket and put him down the dry well. Next time the sleet stopped, I went to Muley's and said, "My daddy's took my big brother, and I guess they up and left me." They took me to the county sheriff, a fat old man named Gosling, and he took me to the child welfare, and I was on the county, as they say. So far as I know, Gosling was the only cop who ever went up there to the home place, and big deal. My own daddy once said, "Sheriff Gosling couldn't find his own ass after he took a shit."
Below this was another space of 3 lines, and when the printing resumed, the last 4 lines of communication from her husband, she could see the effort he had made to get hold of himself, to find his adult self. He had made the effort for her, she thought. No, knew. "Baby love, if you need an anchor to hold your place in the world, not Booyah Moon, but the one we shared, use the African. You know how to get it back. Kisses. At least 1,000. Scott. P.S. Everything the same. I love you." 24. Lacey could have sat there with his letter for a long time, but the afternoon was fleeting. The sun was still yellow, but it was now approaching the horizon and would soon begin to take on that thundering orange cast she remembered so well. She didn't want to be on the path even close to sunset, and that meant she had better get moving now. She decided to leave Scott's final manuscript here, but not under the story tree. She would leave it at the head of the faint hollow that marked Paul Landon's final resting place instead. She walked back to the sweetheart tree with the moss-shaggy trunk, the one that looked weirdly like a palm tree, carrying the remains of the yellow afghan and the damp and mushy manuscript box. She put them down, then picked up the marker with Paul printed on the horizontal arm. It was splintered and bloody and all askew, but not really broken. Lisi was able to straighten the horizontal arm and slip the marker back into its former place. When she did, she spied something lying nearby, something almost hidden in the high grass. She knew what it was even before she picked it up. The hypodermic that had never been used, now rustier than ever, its cap still on.
"Playing with fire there, Scoot,"
his father had said when Scott suggested that maybe they could drug Paul. And his father had been right.
"Damn if I didn't think I pricked myself on it," Scott had said to Lisi when he had taken her to Booyah Moon from their bedroom at the Antlers. "That'd be a joke on me, all right, after all those years. But the cap's still on."
It was still on now, and the nighty-night stuff was still inside, as if all the years between hadn't existed. Lisi kissed the dull glass of the hypodermic's barrel, why she could not have said, and put it into the box with Scott's last story. Then, bundling the wasted remains of Good Ma's wedding afghan in her arms, Lisi went to the path. She glanced briefly at the board lying in the high grass to one side of it, the words on it more faded and ghost-like than ever, but still discernible, still reading, "To the pool," and then passed under the trees. At first she stalked rather than walked, her gait made awkward by her fear that a certain something might be lurking nearby, that its strange and terrible mind would sense her. Then, little by little, she relaxed. The long boy was somewhere else. It crossed her mind that it might not even be in Booyah Moon at all. If it was, it had gone deep into the forest. Lisi Landon was only a small part of its business in any case, and if what she was about to do worked, she would become a smaller part of it still, because her latest intrusions in this exotic but frightening world had been involuntary and were about to cease. With Dooley out of her life, she couldn't think of why she would ever need to come back on purpose. "Some things are like an anchor, Lisi, do you remember?" Lisi walked faster, and when she came to where the silver spade lay on the path, its bowl still dark with Jim Dooley's blood, she stepped over it with no more than a single absent look. By then, she was nearly running. 25. When she came back to the empty study, the top of the barn was hotter than ever, but Lisi was cool enough, because for the second time she had come back soaked to the skin. This time, wrapped around her middle like some strange wide belt, was the remains of the yellow afghan, also sopping wet. "Use the African," Scott had written, and had told her she knew how to get it back, not to Booyah Moon, but to this world. And of course she did. She'd waded into the pool with it wrapped around her, then waded out again. And then, standing on the firm white sand of that beach for what was almost certainly the last time, facing not toward the sad and silent spectators on the benches, but away from them, looking at the waters above which the eternally full moon would eventually rise, she had closed her eyes and simply, what? Wished herself back? No, it was more active than that, less wistful, but not without sadness for all that. "I hollered myself home," she told the long and empty room, empty now of his desks and word processors, his books and his music, empty of his life. "That's what it was. Wasn't it, Scott?" But there was no answer. It seemed he had finally finished having his say, and maybe that was good. Maybe that was for the best. Now, while the African was still wet from the pool, she could go back to Booyah Moon with it wrapped around her if she wanted. Wrapped in such damp magic she might be able to go even further, to other worlds beyond Booyah Moon. For she had no doubt such worlds existed, and that the folks who rested on the benches eventually tired of sitting and rose from their seats and found some of them. Wrapped in the soaking African she might even be able to fly, as she had in her dreams. But she wouldn't. Scott had dreamed awake, sometimes brilliantly, but that had been his talent and his job. For Lisi Landon, one world was more than enough, although she suspected she might always harbor a bone-lonely place in her heart for that other one, where she had seen the sun setting in its house of thunder, while the moon rose in its house of silver silence. But hey, what the smuck. She had a place to hang her hat, and a good car to drive. She had rags for the bod and shoes for the feet. She also had four sisters, one of whom was going to need plenty of help and understanding in order to get through the years ahead. It would be best to let the African dry, to let its beautiful, lethal weight of dreams and magic evaporate, to let it become an anchor again. She would eventually scissor it into pieces and always keep one with her, a bit of anti-magic, a thing to keep her feet on the earth, a ward against wandering. In the meantime, she wanted to dry her hair and get out of her wet clothes. Lisi walked to the stairs, dripping dark drops on some of the places where she'd bled. The wrap of the African slipped down to her hips and became skirt-like, exotic, even a little sexy. She turned and looked back over her shoulder at the long, empty room, which seemed to dream in the dusty shafts of late August sunlight. She was golden in that light herself, and looked young again, although she didn't know it. "I guess I'm done up here," she said, feeling suddenly hesitant. "I'll be going. Bye." She waited. For what, she didn't know. There was nothing. There was a sense of something. She lifted a hand as if to wave, then dropped it again, as if embarrassed. She smiled a little, and one tear fell down her cheek, unnoticed. "I love you, honey. Everything the same." Lisi went down the stairs. For a moment her shadow stayed, and then it was gone too. The room sighed. Then it was silent. Center Level, Maine, August 4th, 2005.
Dancing where the stars go blue. Dancing where the evening fell. Dancing in your wooden shoes in a wedding gown.
Hi, this is Steve King. Thanks for listening to Lisi's story. I hope you liked it. The book concludes with an author statement, and this is it. There really is a pool where we, and in this case by we, I mean the vast company of readers and writers, go down to drink and cast our nets. Lisi's story references literally dozens of novels, poems, and songs in an effort to illustrate that idea. I'm not saying that to try and impress anyone with my cleverness. Much here is heartfelt, very little is clever. But because I want to acknowledge some of these lovely fish and give credit where credit is due. "I'm So Hot, Please Give Me Ice," Trunk Music by Michael Connelly. "Suck Oven," Cold Dog Soup by Stephen Dobbins. "Sweet Mother," The Stones of Summer by Dow Mossman. "Pafko at the Wall," Underworld by Don DeLillo. "Worst Things Waiting," the title of a short story collection by Manly Wade Wellman. "No One Loves a Clown at Midnight," Lon Chaney. "He Was Sweeping, You Sons of Bitches," The Last Picture Show by Larry McMurtry. "Empty Devils," The Tempest by William Shakespeare. "Hell is Empty and All the Devils Are Here." "I Ain't Living Long Like This" was written by Rodney Crowell. Besides Crowell's version, this song has been recorded by Emmylou Harris, Jerry Jeff Walker, Webb Wilder, and Ole Waylon. And of course, Everything by Ole Hank. If there's a ghost in these pages, it's as much his as Scott Landon's. I want to take a moment of your time to thank my wife, too. She's not Lisi Landon, nor are her sisters Lisi's sisters, but I have enjoyed watching Tabitha, Margaret, Anne, Catherine, Stephanie, and Marcella do the sister thing for the last 30 years. The sister thing is never the same from day to day, but it's always interesting. For the stuff I got right, thank them. For the stuff I got wrong, cut me some slack, okay? I've got a great older brother, but I was sister deprived. Nan Graham edited this book. Quite often, reviewers of novels, especially novels by people who usually sell great numbers of books, will say, so-and-so would have benefited from actual editing. To those tempted to say that about Lisi's story, I would be happy to submit sample pages from my first draft manuscript, complete with Nan's notes. I had first-year French essays that came back cleaner. Nan did a wonderful job, and I thank her for sending me out in public with my shirt tucked in and my hair combed. As for the few cases in which the author overruled her, all I can say is, reality is Ralph. Thanks to L and R.D., who were there to read these pages in first draft. Finally, great thanks to Burton Hatlin of the University of Maine. Bert was the greatest English teacher I ever had. It was he who first showed me the way to the pool, which he called the language pool, the myth pool, where we all go down to drink. That was in 1968. I have trod the path that leads there often in the years since, and I can think of no better place to spend one's days. The water is still sweet, and the fish still swim. I will holler you home.
Lisi's story was written by Stephen King and read by Mayor Winningham. The recording engineer was Mitchell Linskoog at Video Box Studios in Los Angeles, with editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. It was mixed by Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Amory Klimchak. Lisi's story was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. When the Stars Go Blue, performed by Ryan Adams. Performance copyright 2001, UMG Recordings, Inc., courtesy of Lost Highway Records, and written by Ryan Adams. Copyright 2001, Barlin Music, BMI, administered by Bug. All rights reserved. Used by permission.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.